This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Alone in the Wild by Kelly Armstrong. Read for you by Therese Plummer. Chapter 1. I wake, buried under 140 pounds of dog. Storm knows she's not allowed on the bed, so I lie there, brain slowly churning, until I remember I'm not in bed. I'm on the ground. Cold, hard winter ground. The floor of a tent that is definitely not big enough for two adults and a Newfoundland dog. Which tells me one adult is gone. I lift my head. Sure enough, there's no sign of Dalton. I peer at the glow of sunrise seeping through the canvas. I've slept in. It's December in the Yukon, when dawn means it's about... I lift my watch. Yep, 10 a.m. I groan. Storm echoes it as she tries to stand, an impossible feat within the confines of this tent. "Where's Eric?" I ask. Shockingly, the dog doesn't answer. I blink back the fog of a night that started with tequila and ended with... Well, it ended strenuously enough to explain why I'm still in bed at 10, though apparently my partner had no trouble rising early. We'd left Storm outside last night. That wasn't cruel. It's hovering around the freezing mark, positively balmy for this time of year. Storm has her thick coat and her companion, a wolf dog named Raoul. We'd brought them on our weekend getaway, both for company and for training. Storm as a tracker and Raoul as hunter. Raoul's master doesn't hunt. Not animals, at least. If Storm is in the tent with the flap closed, that means Dalton let her in. It also means he's taken Raoul. I rub my eyes and spot a note pinned to the tent flap. When I push Storm, she grunts and shifts enough for me to scrabble over her and pluck off the note. Hunting. Back for lunch. Coffee and thermos. Don't wander. The note is the model of reticent efficiency. And I would say that fits our sheriff to a T, but I've also read his near-poetic academic and philosophical musings, ones that shouldn't come from anyone without a PhD, much less a guy with zero formal schooling. That is also our sheriff. Two sides to the same coin. Only I get to see the second one. I find not only coffee, but breakfast and a dog-proof pouch at the end of the bed. Scrambled eggs with venison sausage. And bannock with... I lift the hard bread, still warm from the fire, oozing gooey brown dots. Bannock with chocolate chips. I laugh and take a bite. I won't say I'm a bannock fan, but chocolate makes everything better. I happily munch the bannock and wash it down with coffee. I don't toss any scraps to Storm. Honestly, at her size, she'd never even taste them. Instead, she gets one of my sausages. As for the don't wander part of Dalton's note, I'm interpreting that as a suggestion rather than the imperative, it seems. Oh, naturally, he hopes I'll take it as a command, but he knows better than to expect that. He means for me to stay close, and I will. I'm not about to stay in the tent for two more hours, though. When I finish breakfast, I open the flap and Storm clambers out to romp in the snow. She's 14 months old, which means she's outwardly a full-grown dog, but inside she's still a pup. At 32, I understand the feeling. Or I should say, I've regained the feeling after 16 months in Rockton. Before that, well, I remember a girl endlessly on the move, endlessly into mischief. That girl vanished when I was 18. Shoved into hiding by the kind of mistake that banishes one's carefree inner child. Out here, I found her again. At least when I'm not on duty as Detective Casey Butler. Dalton and I are on vacation, which means we're taking an entire 2 days off. Down south, we'd call that a weekend. Up here, with a police force of three, we take time off where we can find it. Things have been slow in Rockton. The holidays are approaching, and it's as if people decided to cut us slack as a seasonal gift. No assaults, no robberies, no murders, In a town of under 200 people, the last should be obvious. But this is Rockton. Murder capital of the world, someone used to say. That someone knew exactly what she was talking about, having turned out to be a killer herself. Rockton is special, for better or worse. Mostly better, but the crime rate is one of those worse parts. We can't expect otherwise, really. We are a town of fugitives. Everyone here is running from something. Some are victims, on the run from ex-partners, stalkers, anyone who might want them dead through no fault of their own. This is the true purpose of Rockton, a refuge for those fleeing persecution. It's also home to white-collar criminals, whose misdeeds pay our bills. Then there are those whose mistakes, often violent ones, brought them to Rockton under expensively bought cover stories, given even to Dalton. So it's no surprise that we have a murder rate. For now, it's quiet, and has been for 6 months, which means Dalton and I can take an actual weekend off. Storm and I play in the snow for about an hour before I realize that I should have stoked the fire first. While Dalton had left it blazing for me, he's obviously been gone a while, and by the time Storm and I collapse, exhausted, the fire is down to embers. I add another log, but it's not going to take. We need kindling. That's life up here. Constant work just to survive. Heat doesn't come at the flick of a switch. Food isn't the nearest fast food joint away. Water isn't a simple matter of turning on a faucet. In Rockton, we simulate modern living as best we can. There are restaurants in town, and water does come from taps through a pump system. But everyone needs to work to put food in that grocery, to fill the water tanks when the stream runs low. One quickly develops a healthy respect for our pioneer ancestors. Storm and I head out to gather kindling. Soon, though, I realize that new fallen snow is going to complicate the task. Even if I unearth sticks, they won't be dry. That's fine. The best source of winter kindling is dead trees. I'm maybe a few hundred feet from the camp when I find a brown needled pine that's been crowded out by sturdier siblings. I start breaking off twigs. Storm dances about, her second wind gale force strong. When I throw a stick, she chases it, only to notice I'm still snapping off branches. She shoots me a sullen scowl. "I'm not Eric," I say. "I play fetch properly." More scowling. Then she flings herself to the ground with a flounce and a sigh. "Fine," I say with a laugh. "Once and only once." I take another branch and hold it over my head. She stays where she is, watching me, refusing to fall for this again. I throw it, and she doesn't move until I take off after the branch. Then she bolts up and runs for it. I'm one pace ahead, Storm right on my heels. She veers to pass me, and I throw myself down on a home plate slide. I grab the stick, flip onto my back, and fist pump it in the air, giving me 2 seconds of victory before I have a Newfoundland on my face for the second time this morning. Sputtering and laughing, I shove off. Then, punctuating my own noise, I hear something that makes me go still. Storm lumbers off with the stick as I rise slowly, listening. It wasn't what it sounded like. Couldn't be. The noise comes again, a plaintive wail, like a baby's cry. Storm catches it. She stops and pivots, ears perking. She glances at me as if to say, "What is that?" "I don't know," I answer, as much for myself. The morning has gone quiet again, and I'm straining to listen and figure out what it really was. I mentally run through my list of animals that aren't hibernating right now. I've heard a similar sound from a bear cub, but it's the wrong season for that. We have cougars, a female who wandered north of their usual territory and now has grown cubs. The cry didn't sound right for a big cat, not a wolf or a feral dog either. Bird? That seems most likely, and I've decided that must have been what it was when the noise comes again, and it is not like a bird at all. A fox? They make some truly blood-curdling sounds. There's a vixen who lives near our house in Rockton, and I've heard her scream and bolted upright, certain someone was being murdered horribly right outside our window. I'm still standing there pondering when I catch a glimpse of running black fur and realize it's my dog. Storm! I shout as I bolt after her. She stops, and I exhale in relief. This spring, I had to shoot a young cougar she chased. Thus ensued 6 months of special training to be sure no wild animal would ever lead her off again. I jog to catch up. "We'll go check it out," I say. And she may not understand the words, but I only need to take a step toward the sound for her to bark with joy. I motion for her to heel, and she does. Dalton and I have spent countless hours training her, and it's paid off. She's not only blossoming into a first-rate tracker, but she's more obedient than I dared hope. That's a necessity when your dog is bigger than you. Storm stays at my side. When a tree prevents that, she falls behind me as she's been taught. The wail comes again. It's weak enough that if the forest weren't winter quiet, I'd miss it. It sounds so much like a baby that I have to pause and ask myself, why couldn't it be? There are people living out here besides us. Rockton has been around since the 50s, and over the years, residents have relocated into the wilderness for various reasons. Their term ran out in Rockton, and they didn't want to go home. Or they disagreed with the politics, as the town became less an asylum for the innocent and more a pay-to-play escape for the desperate. But they still needed the refuge of the forest. Most of these are what we call settlers, true pioneers of the North, some in communities and some living independently, as Dalton's parents did. Then there are the hostels, and that is a complicated subject that becomes more complicated the longer I'm here and the deeper I dig. When I arrived, I was told that hostels were residents who'd left and reverted to something primitive and dangerous. I'm no longer convinced that all of them chose that reversion. But that's a topic for another time. What matters now is that people do live out here, so I might very well be hearing a human infant. I slow to a walk, straining for the sounds of others. If I hear any, I will retreat post-haste. Even settlers can be aggressive if we wander into their campsites. Yet I hear only the occasional cry of what? Increasingly, I can't imagine as anything except a baby. Then Storm whines. I glance down at her and she stops, parks her butt in the snow and gives me a look that asks if we must continue. She follows it with a glance over her shoulder in the direction of our camp in case I don't understand what she wants. She senses danger ahead. No, I suppose that's melodramatic. To be precise, she smells strangers, and she has learned, unfortunately, that not all strangers are kind. Something in the scent of whatever lies ahead worries her. I motion for her to sit and stay, and she glowers at me. With a grunt, she lifts and then lowers her hindquarters. I'm as trained in Storm's language as she is in mine, and this odd movement tells me that she will sit and stay, but she'd rather come with me. I hesitate. I've learned the hard way that my dog might be the most valuable commodity I own out here. Never mind how well she's trained. One look at her size gets a settler's mind turning, considering how she could be used, as protection or as a beast of burden. Taking her with me is a risk. So is leaving her here, commanded to stay, prey for any human or beast who happens upon her. I nod and motion for her to stay behind me. She doesn't like that, but communicates her disapproval only with a chuff. Then she's right on my heels. After another half dozen steps, there is no doubt that I am hearing a baby. The weak and plaintive cry comes from right in front of me. Yet I see nothing. I blink hard. I'm in an open area scattered with saplings, not big enough to hide someone clutching a child. The cry comes from right in the middle of an empty clearing where I see nothing. Storm whines. When I motion for her to stay behind me, she whines louder, taking on a note of irritation now. She's asking nicely, but she really, really wants the release command. I won't give it. This could be a trap. Someone what? Hiding a recording of a crying child under the snow? I tear into the clearing. The heap ahead looks like a buried log, and it's too large to be a baby, but that's definitely where the sound comes from. As I run, the snow deepens, with no tree canopy to block it, and I'm staggering forward in snow to my knees. I plow through, and I'm almost at the heap when my legs strike something and I stumble. In righting myself, I uncover a boot. In two more steps, I'm beside the heap. The cries have stopped, and my heart stops with them. I claw at the snow. My fingers hit fabric. A woman's body. I can see that in a glance, and again, I don't stop for a better look. She is still, and she is cold, and I cannot help her. I keep digging, but there's just the woman, and for a horrible moment, I imagine the baby trapped beneath her. Then, at a whimper, I realize the sound comes from under her jacket. I tear at it, the fabric frozen and stiff. Blood. I see blood under the snow. I wrestle the jacket open, and there is the baby, clutched to the dead woman's chest. Chapter 2. I yank the child free so fast that the momentum knocks me backward. I land on Storm, and my arms reflexively tighten around the baby, crushing it. No, no, no. I struggle upright as I loosen my grip. So much, I almost drop the baby. I squeeze my eyes shut and shudder. I'm not easily rattled. I've hung off a cliff, fingers slipping, and only thought, damn, this isn't good. But here I am, freaked out. I know nothing about babies, nothing, and I've just dug one out from under the snow, from the arms of the child's dead mother, and focus, damn it, focus. Deep, hyperventilating breaths. Then I gasp. I'm holding a baby that has been exposed to sub-zero temperatures, buried under the snow with its dead mother. There is no time to catch my breath. Clutching the baby, I look around. I spot the nearest object, a fallen tree. I race over, sit, make as much of a lap as I can, and settle the baby on it. Baby. It's a baby, not a toddler, not even a child old enough to crawl. This is an infant so tiny. I suck in a breath. Focus, focus, focus. It's so small. I don't have nieces or nephews, don't have close friends with children. I cannot even guess how young this baby might be. I only know that it is tiny and it is fragile, and for once in my life, I feel huge, massive and clumsy. Even with my gloves off, my fingers fumble with the swaddling. I'm not sure what swaddling should look like, but it's the word that pops to mind. The baby has been wrapped tight in a cocooning cloth, animal hide, tanned to butter softness. As I'm unwrapping the baby, I stop. It's freezing out here, and I'm unwrapping it? But I have to, don't I? To check for frostbite? Warm it up? The panic surges on a wave of indecision. Run the baby back to our tent and unwrap it there. No, unwrap it here quickly and make sure it's fine. The baby makes a noise, too weak now to be called a cry. The child's eyes are screwed shut. They haven't opened since I picked it up. A bitter wind whips past, and I instinctively clutch the baby to my chest. That wind and my reaction answer my question. Get to the tent. To shelter. It's only a few hundred feet away. I open my jacket, and as I do, I curse myself for being a spoiled brat. Last winter, I fumbled around in oversized outerwear, and I'd grumbled about it. And the next time Dalton did a supply run, he returned with a new jacket and snowsuit for me. Naturally, he bought me a sleek, down-filled parka that fits perfectly, meaning I have to hold the baby against my sweater, jacket stretched only partway across. A quick second thought, and I turn my coat around, leaving an air pocket at the top. The whole time I'm fussing, Storm whines, which only fuels my panic. Her anxiety feels like a lack of trust. That's only me projecting, but I snap at her to be quiet. Guilt surges as she ducks her head, and I pat it quickly, murmuring an apology, knowing this is what she really wants, reassurance. I'm freaking out. And that's freaking her out, and she needs to know everything is okay. Once the baby is secured, I start from the clearing. Storm woofs, and I turn to see her staring at the woman's body. Shouldn't we do something about that? Yes. Yes, I should. I am a homicide detective, and that woman is dead, blood soaking the snow. I should at least see what killed her. But I have this baby, and it needs me more than she does. I look up, noting treetop patterns and the sun's position and distant landmarks so I can find this spot again. Then I take off. There is a fresh surge of panic as I leave the clearing and realize that, having been lured by the baby's cries, I'd paid no attention to my surroundings. Why the hell didn't I pay attention? Snow, you idiot. You walked through fresh snow. The path back to our campsite is as clear as a breadcrumb trail. It might meander, and yes, a voice inside screams that I need a direct route, but this is the safe one. I take off at a lope, until I stumble and realize with horror that if I fall, I'll land on the baby. Slower then, step by step. The baby is breathing. Was breathing. No, none of that. There isn't time to stop and check. I've left room for it to breathe, and if it managed to survive under a blanket of snow swaddled beneath its mother's jacket, then it will live through this. As long as it wasn't already too far gone. Enough of that. I tramp through the snow for what seems like miles. Finally, I see our campsite marker high above my head, and I divert to a more direct route. The closer I get, the faster I go. When I jog across big boot prints and smaller paw prints, I stop short. Dalton. I've been in such a blind rush that I've completely forgotten I'm not alone out here, and I nearly collapse with relief at the reminder. I don't care whether Dalton knows the first thing about babies. He's here. I'm not alone. Eric? No answer. I call louder as I continue toward the campsite. I shout for Dalton. I call for Raoul. I whistle and Storm bounds ahead as if this means her co-parent and packmate are back. They aren't. The camp is still and silent, and I realize the boot and paw prints are from earlier. I check my watch to see it's not yet noon. I curse under my breath and keep going into the tent. When Storm tries to follow, a sharp no stops her. She whines, but only once, token protest before she collapses outside, the tent swaying as she leans against it. I left this morning without rolling up our sleeping blankets. I brush the hides flat as quickly as I can. Then I lay the baby on them. The infant lies there, eyes shut, body still. It hasn't moved since I left the clearing. I knew that, but I'd ignored the warning, telling myself it had fallen asleep in relief at being found. As little as I know about babies, I realize this is ridiculous. This is a cold, frightened, hungry infant. When someone came, it should have been screaming, making its needs known now that someone finally arrived to fill them. I lay a trembling hand on the baby's still swaddled chest. I don't feel anything, but I'm not sure I would with the way my fingers are shaking. I check the side of its neck, and as soon as my cold fingers touch warm skin, the baby gives the faintest start. Alive. I fumble to unwrap the swaddling hides. The tiny body gives a convulsive shudder, and I resist the urge to re-swaddle it. The tent isn't warm, but it's sheltered, and I need to get a better look at the child. It is naked under the cloths, a baby girl with black fuzz for hair, her face scrunched up as tight as her fists. I take a deep breath, push aside emotion, and begin an assessment of her condition. That isn't easy. I realize how cold her hands and feet are, and I panic. I notice her shallow breathing and shivering, and I panic. I see her sunken eyes, and I panic. But I keep assessing. Dehydration, mild hypothermia, possible frostbite. Her breathing is clear and steady. Heartbeat is strong and steady. Body is plump and well-nourished. These findings calm and reassure me, and then I can turn my attention to the problems. Triage, frostbite, then hypothermia, then dehydration. I wrap her loosely in her blankets and add a thick hide one. Then I systematically warm her hands and feet, first against my bare skin and then under my armpits. Warm, do not rub. My hands against her button nose and tiny ears as my breath warms those. Now to replenish body fluids. I can tell she's dehydrated, but I can't determine severity. She needs liquid. That's the main thing. I don't have any food for her. I tamp down panic at the thought that I have nothing even resembling milk, water. Focus on getting her water. I hurry out to grab the canteen. Then I stop. Dalton will have it because I won't need it at camp where I can melt snow. Melt snow. I snatch up the pot and stuff it to overflowing with snow and spin to the fire. Oh, the fire is dead. Of course it is. That's why I'd left in the first place, to gather kindling, which I abandoned back in the clearing where I found the baby. I've been gone long enough that the fire is reduced to ash. It'll take forever to get it going enough to melt water. Stay calm. Stay focused. I am surrounded by water in partly frozen form. I can do this. I empty the pot, grab a handful of snow, squeeze it in my fist, and watch the water run into the pot. Grab another, and see black streaks on my hand. It's probably soot, but it looks like dirt, and that reminds me that my hands are not clean. Sterilize. That comes from deep memory. A single babysitting class taken with friends before I realized I was not babysitter material. Then how are you going to look after an infant? I can do this. Clean my hands first. With what? I showered before I came. It's one weekend with backpacks. We have no room for anything we don't absolutely need. And this is an emergency. Am I going to let a baby die of dehydration rather than risk letting her ingest a few specks of dirt? I wash my hands in the snow as best I can. Then I'm squeezing out water when Storm, sticking close and anxious, gives a happy bark. At a whistle, she takes off, and I nearly collapse with relief. Eric, I shout. I need help! He comes running so fast the poor dogs race to keep up. He bursts into the camp as if expecting to see me wrestling a newly woken grizzly. He has a rifle over his shoulder and he's carrying a brace of spruce grouse, which he throws into the snow as he runs toward me. Fire, I say. I need the fire going, now. I have to boil water.
You're hurt? Or Storm?
He wheels to look at the dog bounding up behind him. Baby, I say, barely able to get the word out. My heart thumps so fast. I found a baby.
A baby what?
The infant lets out a weak cry and Dalton goes still. His head turns toward the tent as he asks in a low voice,
What is that?
And I realize he doesn't recognize the sound. Or if he does, it only sparks a very old memory. His younger brother Jacob might very well be the only infant he's ever seen. Dalton was raised in Rockton, where there are no children. Before I can answer, he's crouched and opening the unzipped tent flap. Chapter 3. Dalton gingerly peels back the tent flap. He peers inside. Then he jerks back.
It's a baby.
That's what I said. He rises, looking stunned.
Where?
I found her with her mother under the snow. Both of them, the mother and her child. The mother's dead, and I don't know how long the baby was out there, and I've warmed her up, but she's dehydrated, and I let the fire go out, and now I can't boil water to make it sterile, and... He cuts off my babble with a kiss, gloved hands on either side of my face. Not what I expect, and it startles me, which I suppose is the point. His lips press against mine, warm, the ice on his beard melting against my chin, and it's like slapping someone who is hysterical. Well, no, it's a much nicer way to do it. I'm startled at first, and then all I feel and smell and see is him, and the panic evaporates. Tears spring to my eyes. As he breaks the kiss, he brushes the tears away and says,
Everything's okay. You've got this.
I nod. I don't know much, anything, really, about...
It's more than I do.
He smiles. And then that vanishes, as if he realizes that might not be what I need to hear right now.
We have this,
he says.
We can hold off on sterilizing the water. If she's dehydrated, just use what you have.
He returns to the tent, and I follow with my bit of melted snow. When the dogs crowd in, he waves them back. Storm herds Raoul off like a big older sister taking charge. He's 7 months old. A wolf, an Australian Shepherd cross, heavier on the wolf, which means he understands pack hierarchy. After the dogs move, Dalton reopens the tent. Then he stops and his breath catches.
Fuck,
he whispers.
Are they supposed to be that small?
There's an odd note in his voice, part wonder and part terror. And when I nudge, he moves aside, letting me go in. Then he stays there, holding the flap open.
I'm going to need your help with this, I say.
He nods, rubbing a hand over his mouth as he eases into the tent. He's still a meter away from the baby, but he moves as if he might somehow crush her from a distance. Pick her up, please, I say. I have to get this water into her. He inches closer. His arms move toward the baby, and he stops, repositions his arms, mentally trying to figure out how to do this. You won't break her, I say.
Are you sure?
He gives me a smile, but worry lurks behind it. He looks back at her.
How do I?
One hand behind her back, the other supporting her head. She's too young to hold it up on her own. She's also too young to escape.
Got it.
He still makes a few pantomime attempts, reconfiguring his hands in the air before he actually touches the baby. It's an awkward lift, and when she wriggles, he freezes. I lunge before he drops her. He doesn't, of course. He just tightens his grip a little and looks down at her, and there are experiences I've heard women talk about that I have never had, never even imagined, to be honest. Hearing about them, I'd inwardly rolled my eyes because if I never felt a thing, then clearly this thing does not exist. Or, as I've learned, I just never experienced it until I met Dalton. That thing they write poetry and songs and cheesy Valentine's cards about. Being in love. Being with someone that you can no longer imagine being without. When Dalton holds that baby, I get another of those experiences. My insides just, I don't even know what. I feel things that I don't particularly want to feel at this moment, may not ever want to feel, considering this might be the one thing I can't give him. I see Dalton holding the baby, and then he looks over at me with this little smile that, nope, not thinking about that. Tuck it away. Lock it up tight.
Am I doing it right?
He asks. Yep, I say, a little brusquely. Now I need to get the water into her. I don't know how old she is, but she definitely isn't weaned yet. She'll want something to suck on, but unless you have a clean rubber glove hidden in our packs.
Yeah, no.
I inhale. It probably wouldn't do any good. Suckling requires strength and she's weak. And I need to stop talking. I take a deep breath. From wild panic to overanalyzing.
The situation isn't critical. We're only an hour's fast walk from town. We just need to get a little water into her.
He shifts her, getting more confident in his hold. Then he stops.
She's so
small? He laughs, but it holds a touch of nervousness.
Yeah, we covered that, didn't we? I just can't believe.
He swallows.
All right, I'm going to try to open her mouth so you can drip water in. Just a few drops into the back of her throat, and I'll make sure she swallows it.
Done this before, have you? Another laugh, still nervous.
With a 200-pound man, years ago. Guy who ran away and passed out from dehydration. I had to get fluids into him before I hauled him to town for a saline drip. This is a little trickier. She won't need as much water, though.
True. He puts a finger to the baby's lips. Dalton isn't a huge guy, about 6 feet tall, maybe 170, lean and fit, as he needs to be for life out here. That fingertip, though, seems like a giant's, bigger than the baby's pursed lips. He prods, and her mouth opens.
Now let's just hope I don't get bit.
He wriggles his finger in and then stops.
Though I guess that would require teeth. How young do you think she is?
Babies can be born with teeth, but they usually fall out. They don't get more until they're at least 6 months. She's well below that. Maybe a month?
Fuck.
He takes a deep breath.
Okay, here goes. I'll prob.
Her eyes fly open and he freezes, as if he's been caught doing something he shouldn't. She looks up at him, and it is indeed a picture-perfect scene, as she stares up at Dalton and his expression goes from frozen shock to wonder. I want to capture it, and I want to forget it. I want to pretend I don't see that look in his eyes, don't see his smile.
Hey there,
he says, and the baby doesn't cry, doesn't even look concerned. She just stares at him. Water, I say, and I feel like a selfish bitch for spoiling the moment, but I can't help it. I need to shatter it, and I hate myself a little for that.
Right.
He wriggles his finger into the baby's mouth. She starts to suck on it, and he laughs again. No nerves now, just a rumbling laugh that comes from deep in his chest.
Reminds me of a Martin I found when I was a kid,
he says. A baby Martin? He shrugs.
I had a bad habit of bringing home orphaned animals. My mom,
he trails off, and I realize it's the first time I've heard him use that word. When he speaks of Catherine Dalton, he says, my mother. That isn't who he means here. He means Amy O'Keefe, his birth mother. The parents he never talks about. The ones he can't talk about without a hitch in his words, a trailing off, a sudden switch of subject. He lived with his parents and his brother out here until he was 9, and the Daltons rescued him from a situation he did not need rescuing from. Your mom? I prod, because I must. Every time this door creaks open, I grab for it before it slams shut again.
Water,
he says, and I try not to deflate. I lift the pot and then realize there's no way in hell I can drip it from this suddenly huge pot into her tiny mouth.
Take out one of our shirts,
he says.
Dip a corner in and squeeze it into her mouth.
I'm not sure that's sanitary, but I settle for taking a clean shirt of mine, one fresh from the laundry. As I dip it in, I say, is this how you fed the Martin?
Nah, it's how I fed birds. For the Martin, I'd put food on my finger and hope she didn't chew it off.
He looks at the baby.
You gonna chew it off, kid?
No teeth, remember?
These gums feel hard enough to do the job.
I've relaxed now. He's talking about rescuing orphaned animals, comparing them to the baby, and that eases tension from my shoulders. That's what he sees this as, the rescue of an orphaned creature. Not picking up a baby and being overwhelmed with some deeper instinct that says,
I want this.
That would be silly, I guess. But we all have our sensitive spots, and this is one of mine. The fact that I cannot provide a child should he decide that's what he wants. It's an issue I never had to worry about because I did not foresee myself in a relationship where the question might arise. Now I do. I wet the shirt and trickle water in the baby's mouth. I'm being careful to have it close enough so we can see how much she gets, and suddenly she clamps down on the fabric itself. She sucks hard and then makes such a face that we both laugh. Not what you expected, huh? I say. Her gaze turns my way. I seem to recall that at this age, babies can't see more than shapes, but she's definitely looking, processing. I swear I can see that in her dark blue eyes. Every move, every noise, every passing blurry shape is a cause for deep consideration, her brain analyzing and trying to interpret. I dip the fabric into the pot and press it to her lips. She opens them and sucks, makes that same face, distaste and displeasure, like a rich old lady expecting champagne and being served ginger ale. She fusses, bleats, but when nothing better comes, she takes the shirt again and sucks on it. When she's finished, she fixes us with a look of bitter accusation. Sorry, I say. We'll do better next time. We aren't what she wants, though. Not what she needs. I think of the woman in the clearing, the woman under the snow. We should get her back to Rockton, I say. Can you do that by yourself?
What?
Her mother. I look at the baby. I need to get what I can from the scene.
Scene?
He adjusts his position, making the baby comfortable in the crook of his arm.
You think she was murdered?
Possibly. I know that isn't my crime to solve, but this baby didn't come from nowhere. She has family. She needs to go back to them. I know that better than anyone because of the man sitting beside me. The Daltons found a boy in the forest and they ignored the fact that he was well-fed and properly clothed and healthy. Ignored the fact that he already knew how to read and write. They decided he was a savage in need of rescue. There is no gentle way to put it. They stole Dalton from his parents, from his brother, from the forest. She needs to get back to them, I repeat, and Dalton's hand finds mine, his fingers squeezing as he says,
"She does."
So to do that, I begin.
We have to check out the body.
I have to check it. You need to take her. He passes me the baby and starts rolling the sleeping blankets.
I'm not leaving you out here alone, he says.
And before I can protest, he continues.
Yes, you can find your way back. Yes, you have a gun. Yes, I could leave you with both dogs. But an hour or two will make no difference if she's wrapped well. She survived for longer under the snow.
Yes, but...
Maybe I should stay and check the body, he says, tying the blankets under his backpack. I know what to look for, and I'm better than you at tracking, especially with the snowfall. I might also be able to tell if she's from a settlement or she's a lone settler or even where she comes from.
He settles onto his haunches.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll check the body. You take the baby.
I only glower at him. He grins, leans forward, and smacks a kiss on my cheek.
Yep. I'm not sure which is the scarier prospect. We'll both go check the scene first, wrap her up properly, and I'll break camp.
Chapter 4. We're heading back to the clearing. Dalton has the baby snuggled under his parka, left undone just enough to be sure she's breathing. I'm in the lead, the dogs trotting along beside me, confused but calm, sensing we have this under control. When we reach the deeper snow, it's slow going with the heavy pack on my back. It's not as bad as it sounds, though. On a trip into Whitehorse, I made an amazing discovery. Backpacks are not unisex. I had always worn a regular backpack, and if someone had offered me a girl one, I'd have been offended and amused, like when I saw an ad for a women's pen. Except, as I had discovered, a women's backpack is a perfectly logical invention. The normal ones distribute the load across the shoulders, but women carry weight better at their hips. My new backpack utilized that, and I no longer felt like the 90-pound weakling struggling to carry a backpack half the size of Dalton's. We follow my boot prints into the clearing. A woman died here, and we need to disturb the scene as little as possible. At the clearing edge, I tie Raoul to a tree and command Storm to stay with him. I return to the spot where I unwrap the baby, and I set my backpack in the depression I'd already created. Then I unzip Dalton's jacket and carefully remove the baby. She fusses at being pulled away from her warm cocoon. I check her, and then put her back with Dalton, and she promptly quiets. The body's over here, I say. Dalton follows, staying in my footsteps. The woman lies where I left her, untouched, which is a relief. I'd realized too late that I should have recovered her with the snow to stifle the smell from scavengers. But I suppose being frozen muffled her scent well enough. I was so panicked earlier that I hadn't taken more than a cursory glance at the woman. Now I hunker onto my haunches for a closer examination. She's older than I thought, my initial observation tainted by the expectation that this would be a young mother. I might be wrong on the age, too. This is a hard life for those who've chosen it. Still, the woman's hair is liberally streaked with gray, and I can't imagine she's younger than mid-30s. Still young enough to have a child, of course. She's a settler, not a hostile. In my experience so far, it's been easy to tell the difference. A settler looks like someone who stepped from a magazine article on the Klondike Gold Rush. Sometimes it's the classic version, circa 1898, complete with shabby clothing and beards to their belly buttons. Other times they resemble modern miners, people who choose to spend part of their year here because there is indeed gold in these hills and streams. Hostiles look as if they step from an entirely different magazine article, one about a newly discovered tribe. At least that's the first impression. On closer inspection, it's more like they've compiled the most cringeworthy and stereotypical savage cosplay outfit imaginable. Filed teeth, primitive tattoos, ritual scarring, painted faces, tattered clothing, zero sanitation. This woman might be in need of a long shower, a good haircut, and a visit to the dentist, but she isn't a hostel. Her clothing is well-crafted, her hair is gathered into a rough braid, and she has only a smear of dirt on her face. Otherwise, as clean as if I'd be if we spent a week in this winter frozen forest with no easy access to bathing. She lies on her side, legs drawn up as if she'd gone fetal to protect the baby. Blood soaks the snow around her head and legs, hidden under a cleansing fresh layer. I can't estimate quantity of blood loss by quantity of red snow. I mentally add that to my research list, also known as the list of things I never thought I'd have to know because I'm a homicide cop, damn it. That's not a complaint, just a wry admission that my job down south had been very limited, with experts for everything beyond my immediate scope. Up here, I'm not just a homicide detective, not just a general detective, not even detective plus basic law enforcement. I am all that, and a crime scene tech, ballistics expert, forensic anthropologist, arson investigator, cold case expert, even assistant coroner. If it touches on any area of crime solving, it's mine. Down south, I'd been known as a keener, using my vacation time to attend conferences for areas of crime scene investigation usually handled by experts. I'd been proud of my extracurricular expertise. Then I came to Rockton, and it was like studying French for 2 semesters and taking a job in northern Quebec. Finding the woman's wounds is tricky. Her chest is clean, and there hadn't been any blood on the baby or her blanket. I clear snow from the woman's legs, but she's wearing light tan trousers, and they're only splattered with dark spots that might or might not be blood. "I'm going to roll her over," I say. "How's the baby?"
"Sound asleep."
I glance up sharply at that, and he says,
"I can feel her heartbeat, Casey. She's only sleeping. Keep going."
I ease the woman onto her stomach. I still don't see any sign that bullets or blades pierced her thick parka. I peel the coat off, and there's still no blood. Her shirt is tan, light enough that I would notice blood. I don't. As I ease back, I see a smear of blood on her neck. My gaze moves up to her hat. It's reminiscent of a Russian ushanka, with a tan hide exterior, fur lining, and ear flaps. I untie the straps. When I try to pull it off, it resists. I have to peel it from the back, and her hair sticks to it. Wet hair that froze solid. I run a strand through my fingertips and see red. A blow to the base of the skull. I shine my flashlight to see her hair is plastered over an ugly cut. I palpate the spot. Her skull doesn't feel dented or damaged. A scalp wound bleeds a lot, and that's what soaked the ground around her head. I look at the imprint her body has left. When I picture the body lying not in snow, but on pavement, I envision a blood pool radiating from thigh level. Checking her legs more carefully, I find what I'm looking for. A dark patch on her inner thigh. I picture her position again and see her lying on her side, legs pulled up but parted. I finger the dark patch and find a hole the size of a bullet. Shot in the leg. Did she fall then, or run a little more? Not far before the bullet lodged in the femoral artery. She dropped, lying on her side, cradling the baby as blood ran into the snow. Hit in the head, then shot? I check the scalp again, thinking it might be a bullet graze. No, it's a tear, as if from a tool. Yes, she was indeed hit in the head and then shot. I'm contemplating this puzzle when the baby fusses. That slams home the reminder that this dead body is not simply a puzzle. It's the child's mother. Her dead mother. As cops, we catch a lot of flack for what seems like dispassionate disinterest in the human aspect of our work. That's unfair and untrue. We learn to distance ourselves so we can view a corpse as a mystery. Otherwise, we remember that we're looking at a life snuffed out and we get stuck there. I take a moment to think about this woman, because that helps too. Place her in context. Mother of an infant. Baby wrapped under her jacket when she's attacked. Her killer leaving them both to die. I can't tell if she bled out or died of hypothermia. Either way, she'd been abandoned by a killer heartless enough to let an infant die a slow and horrible death. I carefully remove the dead woman's shirt. 2 shirts, actually. layering for the weather. She's naked under that. No bra, obviously. Brassieres are hardly a priority out here. That does make me stop to consider. Something seems wrong, but I'm no expert on this, and I won't jump to any conclusion, won't even suggest the possibility I see. There's also something else that pulls my attention away from that. Scars. At first, they look like regular scars, old ones. I have more than my share, the permanent reminders of the attack that changed my life. When you are accustomed to seeing scars across your entire body, they become like freckles for those who have them. You're slow to notice them on others. These aren't the sort of scars I bear. There's a pattern here. Raised bumps of scars form a mantle across her chest and shoulders. That's the best way I can describe it. A mantle. Three chains of parallel scars that start on one shoulder, swoop down just over her breasts, and then cross to the other shoulder. Ritualized scarring.
"There's a tattoo, too," Dalton says.
I see it then, on her upper arm. What seems at first a modern circlet tattoo around her biceps, but on closer inspection is rough and primitive. Another one encircles her other arm. I remember something and move to the smear of dirt on her chin. Under it, I see three raised round scars. The dirt seems deliberately smeared on, not painting herself with it, but covering those scars with the only kind of makeup the wilderness allows. "A hostel," I murmur. Then I look at the dirt compared to her tidy clothing and general state of cleanliness. Former hostel. A hostel turned settler. A former hostel with an infant baby, murdered in the snow, both of them left to die. I turn to Dalton. "Should I take her back to Rockton?"
"If it'll help, sure. I can make a stretcher, get Storm to pull it."
"I mean, should I? I'd like to. I need to take a closer look, and I need April's help. But is it right to take her?" He nods, understanding.
"I'd say so. If she has people, they wouldn't have found her under that snow. Taking her back will help you find the baby's family. Seems proper to me."
Chapter 5. We have the woman on a stretcher, which is really just poles with our sleeping blankets between them. We've crafted a makeshift harness for Storm. She's fine with that. We've been training her to pull because, well, it's the Yukon. That's what dogs do up here. Storm finds the pulling easy, the stretcher gliding along the snow. If the dead body bothers her, she's gotten over it. Or maybe because we're moving the woman, she feels as if we're helping her. Our biggest problem is Raoul, who wants to pull, using his teeth. What seems like strong wolf blood in him might also be husky. Plenty of those up here. And they were one breed Rockton had back when they allowed pets. We'll have to get him in a harness this winter for some early training. We're nearing the town when Will Anders comes running, and I tense. Our deputy running to intercept us is never a good sign.
"What's wrong?" I call.
"You're back early, that's what's wrong. Is everything—"
He spots the stretcher and slows. Raoul trots along at Anders' side as our deputy walks over for a closer look. Raoul isn't the most sociable canine, but he has his favorites, which for him means people he allows to touch him. Anders absently pats the young dog as he walks to the stretcher.
"Wounded settler?"
he asks.
"April's off today, but I can run and get her to the clinic."
"This one is beyond my sister's help," I say.
"Dead?"
There's a long moment of silence before he says,
"Not enough murders for you lately, Case? So you're bringing home dead bodies?"
Ha ha. Anders bends beside the stop stretcher. In college, he'd been pre-med before he decided to serve his country as an army medic. They soon switched him to military police. He has a knack for conflict resolution, but he still has the basic medical training, and his gaze sweeps over the woman, assessing.
"Hostile markings. I'm guessing that's your interest, a subject to study."
He rises and undoes Storm's harness, giving her a rub as he sets her free. Then he looks at Dalton.
"Making the pup work, boss? Guess you need to hit the gym a little more, huh?"
Anders flexes a bicep, which would be far more impressive if he weren't wearing a thick parka. Will Anders is a big guy, a couple of inches taller than Dalton, And wider, too, the quarterback to Dalton's running back build. Anders is grabbing the harness when the baby fusses under Dalton's jacket.
What?
Anders says, staring at the moving lump under Dalton's coat.
Please tell me that's another puppy, because I'm still stinging from being overlooked for that one.
He hooks a gloved thumb at Raoul.
I call dibs.
I don't think you want dibs this time, I say. Dalton undoes his jacket just as the baby lets out a wail.
Holy shit.
Anders turns to me.
Either you guys have seriously graduated from orphaned wolf pups, or you are a master at pregnancy hiding.
She was hers, I say, motioning at the dead woman. She's dehydrated and starving. Anders looks at the woman.
Not to question your medical expertise.
I mean the baby, I say with a roll of my eyes. She needs food and medical attention, so we really need to stop talking and get to town. Dalton conceals the baby again and cuts along the back path to the clinic while I accompany Anders and the dogs into town. When we enter, a few people run over. Then they see the body and relax as they realize I haven't brought our sheriff home on a stretcher. There are plenty of people in Rockton who'll mutter after a few beers about how much better life would be without the hard-ass sheriff breathing down their necks. They're like teens whining about strict parents, though. They might complain, but they sure as hell don't want to wake up one day and find mom and dad gone. God knows who they'd get in their place. I field questions, of course. We live in an isolated town of less than 200 people. Everyone's eager for news, for any change to routine, especially in the middle of winter. That would explain the holiday decorations, too. This is my second Christmas here, and as I learned from last year, this place goes a little nuts at the holidays, to stave off going a little nuts in general as the days get darker and the temperature plummets. While Anders pulls the stretcher, we pass residents adding to the decorations. Heaven forbid a single wooden porch should lack evergreen boughs woven through each railing baluster. Or any door should lack an intricately crafted wreath. Or any lintel should lack ivy with bright red cranberries. Every tree has been decorated, and that's saying something in a town filled with evergreens. That's still not enough, and people have decorated all the perimeter trees too. Making holiday ornaments is an all-year craft for some. I can grumble, but that's more eye-rolling than actual complaint. And even the eye-rolling covers the fact that I secretly love the way Rockton embraces the holidays. My parents celebrated Christmas. My mother wanted her daughters fully assimilated, and any of her own Chinese or Filipino family traditions were ignored. We were Canadians, and we would act Canadian, which apparently meant Christian at the holidays, even if we never attended church of any kind. Neither of my parents was all that keen on Christmas, though. It seemed like more chore than delight for them, an unwanted distraction from their careers. We did all the basics, set up a tree, put out stockings for Santa, exchanged gifts, and then had a holiday meal. But the tree went up Christmas Eve and was taken down Boxing Day. There were no concerts or parties. My parents didn't have time for that. Well, no, they attended holiday parties. I remember them dressed up, April babysitting me, but only because the social events were necessary evils for career networking. In Rockton, we celebrate all the winter traditions, and that sounds very inclusive of us, but honestly, I think it's just an excuse for more parties. If that leads to a greater understanding of different traditions and faiths, it's a bonus. There are no churches in Rockton, but only because we don't have space for buildings that'll be used once a week. Services are held at the community center with the various groups agreeing to a schedule. If there's an overriding theme to our winter celebrations, it's solstice. That makes sense up here where we are enslaved to sun and season. Next week is winter solstice, the longest night of the year. The party will last for every minute of it as we celebrate the return of the sun, knowing each day following will be longer. Until summer solstice, when the town will party from 4 a.m. sunrise to midnight sundown. When you live without TV and social media, you exploit every excuse for a celebration. My mood lifts on seeing the decorations. With Rockton's wooden buildings and Wild West flair, there's nostalgia there, too, even for someone who doesn't consider herself particularly nostalgic.
Squint past the modern clothing and you can imagine a town from times past, bedecked in its holiday finest, everyone's step lighter as they pass, their smiles wider. Those smiles dim when they see the dead body on the stretcher, but even then, it's simple curiosity. We are, indeed, in so many ways, the Wild West town we resemble, where violence and death are as much a part of life as decorating for the holidays. I head to April's house, beside the clinic. Like Dalton, Anders, and myself, she gets a small 1.5-story chalet to herself. That's the perk of being essential services. Rockton could build one for each resident. We certainly have the land, but the larger the town is, the more likely it is to be spotted by planes. We use both structural and technological camouflage to prevent that, but we still need to keep our footprint as small as possible. Anders takes both dogs to Raoul's owner, Matthias, who will look after Storm while we're busy with this problem. I rap on my sister's door. I almost hope that she doesn't answer. Or that, if she does, she has company. It's her day off, and it'd be nice if she was spending it home alone, but with April, that's like saying it'd be nice if the temperature hit 30 Celsius today. It just ain't happening. No, that isn't entirely true. It would have been when she first arrived. Now there is a chance she'll be out, not exactly socializing, but at least interacting. Inviting someone into her home is too much. She'd been known to haul the toilet tank onto her back porch for pickup to avoid having anyone come inside. April opens the door as I'm reaching for a second knock. "What are you doing back?" she says. "Nice to see you too, April." Her brows crease as if she's trying to figure out why it would be nice to see her. Isabel, a former psychologist, believes my sister is on the autism spectrum, undiagnosed because my parents refused to see anything wrong with their brilliant older daughter. They had enough trouble dealing with their rebellious younger one. To them, a diagnosis of even mild autism would have meant April was intellectually imperfect. And so they instead let her struggle through life, a gifted neurosurgeon and neuroscientist unable to form all but the most tenuous of personal relationships, lonely and alone and never knowing why. My parents screwed up my life in so many ways, but compared to what they did to my sister, I got off easy. When we raised the possibility of autism with April, I'd been terrified she'd see it as sibling envy, me trying to knock down my brilliant older sister. I'd been convinced otherwise by a joint coalition of Isabel, Kenny, and Dalton, and they'd been right, which is humiliating to admit, proving how little I know my sister. Too much familiarity and too little actual understanding, a lifetime of trying to get to know her and, when I couldn't, creating her wholesale. April was fine with the diagnosis. She treated it the way I would have, like a physical ailment. Here's the problem, and now that we know what it is, let's tackle that. Relief, I think, at giving it a name. "I brought you a body," I say. Her frown deepens, and she's looking for some alternate meaning in this, a sign that I'm joking. "I found a murdered woman in the forest," I say. Now she relaxes, and I get the April I know well, rolling her eyes at her feckless little sister. "Really? You don't have to make the world's problems your own, Casey." "You know me, can't relax, always looking for work. If I don't have it, I make some." I pause, which does not mean I made this dead body. That would be wrong. A pause, then, "That's a joke, isn't it?" I clap her on the arm as I propel her back into the house. "Yes, April, it's a joke." I pull shut the door before she can protest. "Don't worry, I'm not coming in for tea. I found something else, which I'd rather not broadcast." Chapter 6. After I explain, we head out April's back door and across her yard to the clinic's rear entrance. As we do, she says, "I hope you're not thinking of adopting this child, Casey." I tense so fast, my spine crackles. "No, I'm not stealing someone's baby, April. The mother is dead. That is not stealing. Presumably, the father is alive and potentially other family, which I'm going to find." "Good. This isn't a stray puppy." My teeth barely part enough for me to say, "I'm aware of that.
But one of my sister's cognitive challenges is interpreting body language, so she ignores that and continues. There is no place in your life for a baby, Casey. I realize you're comfortable here and you've settled into a long-term relationship with Eric, but this is not a situation for motherhood. I found a baby with a dead mother, buried under the snow, alone and in distress. I brought her back to Rockton so she doesn't die, not to fill a hole in my life. There is no hole in your life. You have Eric, and you have Storm, and you have Rockton, and your job. You are happier and more satisfied than I have ever known you to be. I answer slowly, keeping my tone even. I appreciate the fact that you recognize I'm happy, April, and there isn't a baby-sized hole in my life. I just happened to find a child whom I intend to return to her family. Just because I'm a woman in a happy romantic relationship doesn't mean my ovaries go into hyperdrive seeing a baby. Good. I push open the back door of the clinic with a little more force than necessary. I tell myself that April isn't being patronizing. I've spent my life dealing with this from her, and I'm trying to understand that she doesn't mean it the way it sounds. Yet it's also a constant reminder that my sister put me into my box when we were young, and nothing I've done since then has, or possibly ever will, let me escape it. I'm reckless. I'm impulsive. I'm thoughtless, rushing headlong into every bad decision life offers. My sole consolation is that anyone who knows me would laugh at all those descriptors. Inside, Dalton and Anders have the baby on the examining table. As soon as I see that, I barrel into the room and snatch her up. You can't leave her on that, I say. What if she rolls off?
She can't even lift her head, Casey,
Anders says. Which doesn't mean she can't wriggle or slide, he snickers.
Slide off a flat surface?
You are both correct, April says. It is almost certainly safe, given the child's lack of mobility, but a slippery metal table still doesn't seem like the safest place to set a baby. She aims a look at Anders.
Hey, I'm not the one who put her there,
Anders says.
And Eric literally just unwrapped her as you two came in.
April nods at Dalton, as if to say that if he did it, then it's fine. The first time they met, she referred to him as my fuck toy. And I'm not sure what was more shocking, the word coming from my very proper sister, or the sentiment coming from my very straight-laced sister. In the last 6 months, she's done a complete about-face, and now, if Dalton does something, then it's the right thing to do. I'm totally on board with her not treating my lover like trash, but I can't help wishing I could get a little of that approval thrown my way. Eric, she says, it's a bit chilly in here for the baby. Could you... She looks over to see he's already starting the fire, and she nods, pleased that her trust is so well placed. Anders and I exchange a look. I hold the baby until the fire's blazing and the chill is leaving the room. Then I lay her on the exam table. Would you take over? I ask Dalton. I need to find something for her to eat. Yes, April says, not looking up from her examination of the baby. We'll need formula and bottles, also diapers for the inevitable after products of feeding. Tell the general store to put together a box of all their infant supplies. Anders, Dalton, and I all look at one another. I say, we don't carry infant supplies. We don't have any infants.
In case you haven't noticed that in the past 6 months,
Anders murmurs. April shoots us both a glare of annoyance. Yes, I have noticed there are currently no babies, but I'm sure there are supplies in storage for them. There aren't, I say. We don't ever have babies here, or children, or even teenagers. She glances at Dalton.
Yeah,
he says.
I was special, but Casey's right. We don't allow anyone under 18. And there's a reason why we have a shitload of condoms and diaphragms and every other method of contraception. We're not equipped to handle childbirth or children.
April flutters a hand at me. Just get whatever. As I hurry through town, I'm trying to figure out what I can get. Milk is the obvious choice. We have it in powdered form, and I know that's less than ideal, but it's that or nothing. As I'm racking my brain for alternate foods, I keep thinking, I can Google that. For someone raised on modern technology, it's a natural instinct. Well, unless it's a medical question, where even I have an odd rash on my thumb will lead to cancer, death, plague. 16 months in Rockton have not yet rerouted my neural circuits enough to keep me from reaching toward my pocket every time I have a research question. Now, instead of a cell phone, I carry a notepad, where I can write down all those questions for the next time I'm in Dawson City with internet access. This problem won't wait that long. I need to find a resident who has had a child. That should be easy enough in a town full of people in their prime child.